The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. Icarian Curcumin and Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. It's the story of your life. You're moving down the page. And you know you... Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, candidate Hugh Hewitt on this Thursday. Looking forward to talking to President George W. Bush. The former president will be joining me later today to discuss his brand new book, Out of Many, One. We're looking forward to having him back. It's always good to talk to the former president. I want to begin, though, with not the biggest story of the day. It's not even close to being the biggest story of the day. I'll come to those in a second. But it's the one that bugs me the most because it's premised on stupidity. Speaker Pelosi gave a press conference yesterday. And if you're watching on YouTube, or if later on you watch this on my podcast, Hugh Hewitt Show, or Hugh Highly Concentrated Hugh, or on my other podcast, The Interview, I don't know how it would end up there, but it could end up somewhere. If you see it anywhere, I want you to watch this if you're watching on YouTube. Here's Nancy Pelosi getting a question at her presser yesterday about District of Columbia statehood cut number 12.
Statehood for the District of Columbia. I proudly wear this 51 hat. So it's an honor to join Democrats from both.
Okay, so she's wearing a mask that has the number 51 on it in D.C. Let me just... The reason this annoys me so much is it's based on your not knowing what the Constitution says. She ought to know what the Constitution says. The 23rd Amendment to the United States Constitution extends the right to vote in presidential elections to citizens residing in the District of Columbia. The amendment grants the district electors in the Electoral College as though it were a state, though the district can never have more electors than the least populous state. The 23rd Amendment was proposed in 1960, and it was ratified in 1961. So the status of the District of Columbia is fixed in the Constitution. That means for D.C. to achieve statehood, there has to be a constitutional amendment, not a statute. This is Government 101. It's eighth grade civics. And so when the Speaker of the House stands up and says the 51st Senate and the House moves to pass, D.C. is a 51st state, they are ignoring the Constitution, which they have taken an oath to uphold and defend. And it offends me that they just don't honestly tell you it is unconstitutional to simply pass a law declaring D.C. a state. They can do that with Puerto Rico. And in my view, that's up to the people of Puerto Rico to petition for it if they want it. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It's never gotten to the Congress. Completely legit to make Puerto Rico a state. You cannot make D.C. a state unless you first change the Constitution. You cannot, as Senator Romney proposed, revert D.C. to Maryland without first changing the Constitution. The status of the District of Columbia is fixed by the Constitution. We are people governed by the rule of law, and we've got to stop that nonsense. And I will bring it up every single... There's lots of nonsense. Chuck Schumer yesterday, nonsense. Floor of the Senate, cut number 9.
These voter suppression laws, more than 250 proposed laws in more than 40 states, constitute a grave and immediate threat to the very core of our democracy. In ways both large and small, they seek to restrict the franchise...
Can we stop there? It's all a lie. It's just a giant lie. The Democrats are lying. There are no voter suppression laws. There are lots of voter verification laws. They do not want voter verification. I believe that's because they know whatever cheating occurs at whatever level, it advantages Democrats, and they want it easier to cheat than not to cheat. That's what it's all about. They call cheating voter suppression. Anti-cheating laws are called voter suppression. Why does it matter? Because sometimes you end up with elections like the Iowa congressional seat that was won by 6 votes for the Republican. And if it's not close, they can't cheat. But that was awfully close. So someone could cheat. So we don't want people to cheat in elections. We want to fix elections and make sure they don't cheat. We don't want mail-out ballots. We do not want to mail out ballots to the whole wide world. I've told you many times, I continue to receive ballots at my old address in California. I left California in 2016. California needs to change its rules, clean up its rolls, and move away from ballot harvesting. It's bad for the country. Let me give you some other news updates. India has a problem on their hands. The health ministry reported 312,731 new infections yesterday. It's the most recorded in that country on a single day. A total eclipsed the one-day high of 300,669 recorded in the United States on January 8th. India is going to break all of our records. And remember, they're not the records in the world because the other third world countries do not keep track, like Brazil. Like, we don't know what China is doing because China lies. On Thursday, India recorded 2,104 deaths, an average of more than 1,300 people have died of the virus every day for the past week. So India is in the grip of the virus, and the virus will variate, which is why you need to go and get vaccinated as a public duty. It is a requirement of good citizens to go, and not a law, no one can force you. But good citizens will go get vaccinated for fear that a variant will get here and you will be the carrier for it. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is considering deploying a carrier close as possible to Afghanistan, either the overstretched Eisenhower, which has been out there for a while, or the Theodore Roosevelt, because they want to protect, quote, a military retrograde operation. That means to get everybody out, which President Biden has ordered, you sometimes have to send in additional troops and you have to be able to protect their rear as they are retreating from the country. The Pentagon is concerned that the exit could draw fire from Taliban fighters hoping to put a final punctuation on what the militant group is presenting as a humiliating American defeat. Biden administration officials sounded a tough line about retaliation if the Taliban mounts any attacks on retreating troops. But the insurgents' intentions are unclear while its leadership meets in Pakistan to decide its next step. President Biden is also making news by saying he is poised to recognize the massacre of Armenians as a genocide, officials say. Long been avoided, long been overdue. I have no problem with that. Most historians recognize the Ottoman Empire's treatment of Armenians and members of other ethnic and religious minorities from 1915 to 1923 as a genocide. There is a genocide underway in China right now against the Uyghur people and other minorities in Xinjiang province. So I'm all in favor of clarity. So maybe the president will finally get that done. Putin gave a very, very pugnacious speech yesterday, warning ominously of red lines in Russia's security that, if crossed, would bring a powerful asymmetric response. He reminded Western leaders once again of the fearsomeness of his country's modernized nuclear arsenal, and he boasted of Russia's moral superiority over the West. It's a snapshot of Russia in the third decade, according to the Times, of Mr. Putin's rule, a leader facing an increasingly angry and desperate opposition, but firmly in power with his country's vast resources and huge security apparatus at his disposal. China, meanwhile, has launched another hack against the United States. It's behind a newly discovered series of hacks, according to the NBC News, against key targets in the U.S. government, private companies, and the country's critical infrastructure, according to the cybersecurity firm Mandiant, who put the press release out yesterday. The hack works by breaking into Pulse Secure, a program that businesses often use to let workers remotely connect to their offices. The company announced Tuesday how users can check to see if they were affected, but said the software update to prevent the risk to the users won't go out until May. That's just great. Also a great story on China's fishing fleet, which you might not think is a big deal, but it's an enormous deal. It's pushing to become a maritime superpower. I'm going to have Captain Jerry Hendricks on later about a Wall Street Journal piece that he has out today about our need for infrastructure to support our shipping fleet. But China's shipping fleet is vast. It now is staking out a bigger presence at sea by building out a worldwide network of ports. The vessels, which are rigged with winches and booms and pulling giant nets, can be twice as large as a naval patrol boat, almost 200 feet long. There are as many as 17,000 of these ships, 17,000. They roam the world. Ecuador and Purdue placed their navies on alert last year to track hundreds of Chinese trawlers. And the journal goes through, they're in Ghana, they're in Samoa, they're in the Galapagos Islands. They are everywhere, feeding this vast splurge. A 2019 global ranking by Geneva-based Global Initiative placed China first in the prevalence of illegal fishing by nation. All right, so it is a rogue fishing fleet. And distant water fishing is enshrined in Xi Jinping's National Development Blueprint, a key part of his Belt and Road Initiative. And you should be aware of it. It's a menace. More coming up on the Shooting Columbus. More news, lots more audio, and of course, George W. Bush all ahead on today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm about to go okay boomer on you. Last night, it's Thursday, April the 22nd in the year of our Lord, 2021. Now, last night at about 4:55 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the New York Times dropped an article. And I have little pings when articles go up on any of my papers, and I read the Times of Israel, Financial Times, Telegraph, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post every day and every evening. And I'm doing my show prep, and I see a little ping. And here's a bearded millennial with his white socks and sandals on, sipping a drink by a pool, and it's called The Shift. Welcome to the YOLO economy. Subhead. Burned out and flush with saving, some workers are quitting stable jobs in search of a post-pandemic adventure. This is by Kevin Ruse, R-O-O-S-E, and it was posted last night and updated at 4:55 p.m. Something strange is happening to the exhausted type A millennial workers of America. Millennial workers of America. I believe that means that you are between the ages of 25 and 35. Am I right about that? What's a millennial? Before I go off and castigate people who are not in this demographic, let's just find out what a millennial is. Just to be careful, I want to look it up. Who are the millennials? 81 to 97. If you were born in 1981 through 1997, 1996, according to the New York Times, you're age 25 to 40. That's where I was wrong. If you're 25 to 40, they wrote this story about you. Burned out and flush with savings, some workers are quitting stable jobs in search of post-pandemic adventure. Now, I believe this is a slander on a generation, but it applies to some of you. Something strange is happening to the exhausted type A millennial workers of America. After a year spent hunched over their MacBooks, enduring back-to-back Zooms in between sourdough loaves and Peloton rides, they are flipping the carefully arranged chessboards of their lives and deciding to risk it all. Some are abandoning cushy and stable jobs to start a new business, turn a side hustle into a full-time gig, or finally work on that screenplay. Others are scoffing at their bosses' return to office mandates and threatening to quit unless they're allowed to work wherever and whenever they want. They are emboldened by rising vaccination rates and a recovering job market. Their bank accounts fattened by a whole year of stay-at-home savings and soaring asset prices have increased their risk appetites. And while some of them are just changing jobs, others are stepping off the career treadmill altogether. If this movement has a rallying cry, it's YOLO, You Only Live Once, an acronym popularized by rapper Drake a decade ago and deployed by cheerful risk takers ever since. The term is a meme among stock traders on Reddit, who use it when making irresponsible bets that sometimes pay off anyway. This year's GameStop trade was the archetypal YOLO. More broadly, it has come to characterize the attitude that has captured a certain type of bored office worker in recent months. To be clear, the pandemic is not over, and millions of Americans are still grieving the loss of jobs and loved ones. You think? Yes, indeed, you should think that. Not everyone can afford to throw caution to the wind, you think? Yep, that's true, too. But for a growing number of people with financial cushions and in-demand skills, the dread and anxiety of the past year, are giving way to a new professional fearlessness. That looks great, Ben. I just saw what you were doing on the screen. Ben is a millennial who gets up every morning at 2:30 in the morning or 2:15 in the morning, as does Harley, another millennial. And they have second jobs, and they are not covered by this story. I started hearing these stories, says the writer, this year when several acquaintances announced they were quitting prestigious and high-paying jobs to pursue risky passion projects. Since then, a trickle of LinkedIn updates has turned into a torrent. I tweeted about it, and dozens of stories poured into my inboxes, all variations on the same basic theme. The pandemic changed my priorities, and I realized I didn't want to live like this. Brett Williams, 33, a lawyer in Orlando, Florida, had his YOLO epiphany during a Zoom mediation. That's a little bit less offensive, a Zoom mediation in February. I realized I was sitting at my kitchen counter 10 hours a day feeling miserable, he said. I thought, why do I have to lose? We could all die tomorrow. So he quit, leaving behind a partner position and a big firm's salary to take a job at a small firm run by his next-door neighbor and to spend more time with his wife and dog. I'm still a lawyer, he said, but I haven't been this excited to go to work in a long time. Newsflash. Lawyers have been doing this since I was 33 and I'm 65. They've been doing it since I was 23 and 13. It's called getting out of a big firm and going to a small firm, and it's not a dramatic move. It's kind of a lifestyle choice. It's not a millennial thing. It's not exhausting from the pandemic. It's a choice. Olivia Messer, a former reporter for the Daily Beast, also quit in February after really realizing that a year of covering the pandemic had left her exhausted and traumatized. Really ought to try being on the air 9 hours when 9/11 goes down and the subsequent 3 months. Really, Olivia. I was so drained and depleted that I didn't feel like I knew how to do my job anymore. So Ms. Messer, 29, announced her departure and moved from Brooklyn to Sarasota, Florida, near her parents. Since then, she's been doing freelance writing as well as pursuing hobbies like painting and kayaking. No word from the parents. If languishing is 2021's dominant emotion, YOLOing may be the year's defining workforce trend. A recent Microsoft survey found that more than 40% of workers globally were considering leaving their jobs this year. Blind, an anonymous social network that is popular with tech workers, recently found that 49% of its users plan to get a new job this year. Getting a new job is great. More money, fewer hours if you can find it. It's the idea that you only live once and you can live irresponsibly that gets me. We're all had a year to evaluate if the life we're living is the one we want to be living, said Christina Wallace, a senior lecturer at Harvard Business School. Especially for younger people who've been told to work hard, pay off your loans, and someday you'll get to enjoy your life, a lot of them are questioning that equation. What if they want to be happy right now? Well, that's where I want to stop. I want to stop with Christina Wallace, a senior lecturer at the Harvard Business School, saying, especially for younger people who have been told to work hard, pay off your loans, and someday you'll get to enjoy your life, a lot of them are questioning that equation. What if they want to be happy right now? Well, if you want to be happy right now, go to church, keep your job, and pay your debts. If you want to be happy, serve somebody. If you want to do anything worthwhile, serve people. Don't complain. Don't tell me how hard you've had it, because you've not had it hard. You folks weren't actually at risk during this. Now, you might have had a grandma that you couldn't see. You might have lost someone in your family life. But the idea that this year has been uniquely hard on anyone with a job is ridiculous. You know, it's been hard on restaurant owners who risked everything and had their restaurants collapse. It's been hard on people who were close to a startup, had second round funding, and then had it fall apart in front of them. It's been very tough on those workers at plants that had to close because of virus disruption. It's been very hard on employers like my friend Rhett Rasmussen at Solaire, besthotgrills.com, who've had to deal with all the local authorities, and appropriately so, and well done, and make sure that every sort of spacing was done and meet overwhelming demand because their products, Best Hot Grills and Best Hot Grill Fire Logs and Best Hot Grill Patio Heaters, are in huge demand. They've had huge demand in times of supply disruption. I think of my buddy Glenn, who runs a restaurant chain, general counsel for that. And I'm thinking of how much he's had to work. So all you YOLOing millennials who are complaining that you've been hunched over your computers, go to work, go to church, serve somebody, and be happy you live in America that has a vaccine and not India, which had 300,000 infections yesterday and doesn't have a vaccine distribution system. I read this after I finished this book, Out of Many One, Portraits of America's Immigrants. And I'll talk about it with Debbie a little bit later. But there is so much suffering in this book as people have made their way to America. When you run into an entitled, selfish, yellowing millennial who's thinking about cutting back from their 5 hours a day in front of the computer for a social network like Valter in The Succession, ask him just to read a few of these stories. The idea that an immigrant would complain about having one job that they had to work 10 hours a day at, as opposed to be saying a lawyer in Vietnam who came over with the boat people and had to cut grass, or a child who got picked up at Da Nang orphanage and ends up at Lake Superior and ends up getting 3 degrees, including one from MIT. The stories of hardworking immigrants will put you to shame to the millennials. Now, I don't live by the yellow. I live by the Tank Hewitt system, which is get a job. You're 21. Now, Tank and Marguerite, mom and dad, paid for college, didn't pay for the beer. I had to go to work at 14 for caddying, not for the beer, but just for spending money. I'm sure there was no beer involved. And then in college, I did the same thing. I was a lifeguard in the summer. I was a lifeguard during the year. I had one other job. I was a newspaper delivery boy when I first got to Harvard because I needed a job. And that was a pain in the butt job, literally, because I kept falling down in the snow and ice between the yard and Radcliffe, which is a pain in the butt to fall down all the time. So I went back to being a lifeguard at the indoor athletic IAB. I think it was called the IAB. I mean, a wretched place to work, but it was nevertheless, they allowed you to smoke. In those days, I smoked, and I would sit there and watch the swimmers swim. And that was my other job. And that wasn't very hard. I never complained about that because lifeguarding is the easiest job in the world. And I was a lifeguard in the summer. The only other job I ever had was working for Robert Bentley Publishers, which involved taking out the trash, shipping books, changing toner, that kind of stuff. But I always had a job. And I've never not had 3 jobs for the last 35 years. And I've always had at least 2. And to the millennials out there who are complaining that life is hard and they want very much not to. I like that, Ben, too. You're looking very good, Ben. Looking very good. I just want to say this wasn't particularly hard year unless you were sick or knew someone who was sick. Now, in a nation of 330,500,000 people died of COVID or COVID-related death. That's a lot of death. It's a lot of sorrow. I'm not minimizing that. Most of you had some disruption in your life. It's not like World War II. It isn't anything at all like 9/11. It is not like being a soldier, sailor, airman, or marine. It's not like being out on the Coast Guard chasing drug traffickers. It's not like you are working outdoors in the cold and the heat. As I live in Northern Virginia, I see the workers out there every day building everything that can be built in all kinds of weather. And I think to myself, YOLO yourself, you know where it YOLOs, where the sun doesn't shine. Go on and YOLO yourself. That article really ticked me off. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Thursday, April the 22nd. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. If you open up your Wall Street Journal this morning, you saw an op-ed by my friend Captain Jerry Hendricks, the author of the wonderful book To Provide, Maintain, a book on what the United States needs for its Navy to be a 21st century Navy that has really skyrocketed around the Beltway and the Pentagon. But he hadn't put his pen down. He got a new op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this morning, which is about infrastructure. Good morning, Captain Hendricks. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm doing just fine.
You know, I got to tell people that I know we woke you up early this morning. I originally offered to have you on in the first hour, and you said, you know, that's a little bit early, which kind of astonished me because, you know, your call sign was Farmer long ago, and you were a pilot in the Air Wing in the Naval Academy, and you were a farmer because you allegedly lived on a farm in Indiana, but you can't get up in the first hour. I'm really kind of stunned by that.
Well, you know, I actually messaged you at 5:45 this morning to let you know I'd already fed the chickens and milked the cow. And I was hoping your show prep was going along. And also, I was a naval flight officer, and I graduated from Purdue ROTC, not the academy.
I didn't go to the trade school. That's it. You didn't go to the trade school, but you're a Purdue, you're a corn-fed Purdue graduate. And look, everyone who's out there, Purdue is a degree-granting institution. They don't have football, but they are a degree-granting institution. Captain, you've done a great public service. This is an important op-ed, and I don't want to joke around too much like I do with Talent and Gallagher, because you're talking about President Biden's proposed $2 trillion American Jobs Act, which is an infrastructure bill. And you said, okay, here's the infrastructure we need. Tell us about what you think that money should go to, at least in part.
Well, I think that the one thing that's being missed in our public conversation right now is the importance of shipbuilding and ship repair with regard to infrastructure. I'm all for roads and bridges, upgrading communications. But at the same time, I think if you're going to look strategically at where the United States is in the world, then we really have to look very closely at shipbuilding. I had an epiphany a few years ago when we had the two collisions in 2017 that involved the destroyers McCain and Fitzgerald, and we had to put those ships in for repair due to the damage, and it actually took them longer to be repaired than what it originally took us to build them and put them in commission. That's simply because we don't have enough excess capacity in our shipbuilding and repair infrastructure in this country in order to kind of take ships that have been damaged. And when you think about the growing potential of conflict with China or Russia, we recognize we're in this great power competition with these two great powers. You know, you're going to have ships damaged, and you're going to need to have a place to bring them home, place them into dry docks, have them repaired in order for them to return to battle. And quite frankly, right now, Hugh, we simply don't have that excess capacity. And so I wanted to write this op-ed to raise this issue and ask the president and his administration to look at investing in shipbuilding and repair.
Let's break it down for the Steelers fans, Captain Hendricks. What is a dry dock? More importantly, what is a shipyard? And why can't we just throw them together when we need them?
Well, first of all, it's a highly, you know, technically complex industrial action. You know, a shipyard, you know, brings together everything from steel to electrical to plumbing, to heating and air conditioning. It all comes in to great, you know, create these very complex mechanisms, which are ships. This is largely done in things like we call graving docks or dry docks, where the ships are brought together, their components are assembled, and then they're launched. We use the dry dock or graving dock structure specifically when we're doing a lot of ship repair. So the ship's already been built. It needs to be brought in from the sea, placed into a dry dock, the water drained out of it, and then the ship to be repaired, opened up, as it were, and then repaired. So these are very complex industrial, you know, activities. During World War II, we had over 50 shipyards in the United States. The U.S. Navy itself had 10 shipyards that it owned itself. And then there was an additional 50 commercial shipyards, which were building commercial as well as Navy ships to include destroyers or cruisers. And today, we're down to less than 20 of those. The Navy has gone from 10 internal dry shipyards down to four. And then our commercial sector has shrunk considerably, specifically after the end of the Cold War. And so as we look at this great power competition that we're reentering, we really need to look at what is it going to take to compete and win in that. And right now in shipbuilding, we are way behind. We have very little excess capacity. Even if Congress was to double the amount of spending on shipbuilding today, it would take us a couple of years to be able to absorb that and for industry to plan and expand its production capacity. And we haven't sent a clear and consistent enough signal to shipbuilding for it to do that.
Now, you mentioned, I think, the most important comparison. We have four Navy shipyards and 10 commercial, or 40 commercial. So 4 and 40, is that right, or 4 and 10?
No, actually, it's four Navy shipyards and then less than 20 right now. I can count 14. There may be a few others that have these agreements with the Navy that I'm not aware of, but I know of at least 14 where we're looking at shipbuilding and then also repair. And that's just far too little to be able to handle the competition.
So then let's compare to what the People's Republic of China has right now, because this is the eye opener in your Wall Street Journal story today. How many shipyards does China have?
So China actually has, we estimate, 1,200 shipyards. One of those shipyards alone outproduces the entire U.S. Industrial shipbuilding capacity, just one that's located on this one island where they're producing more tonnage per year than virtually anyone else in the world. We made a decision as a country back in the 1980s that we would no longer subsidize our shipbuilding industry. China, the Koreas, or South Korea, and Japan all provide significant subsidies to their shipbuilding industry. And right now, they dominate. Almost 90% of shipbuilding capacity in the world is located in those three countries. Europe also subsidizes its shipbuilding industry. They also build a lot of ships there. The United States builds very little, unfortunately. We have two shipyards that really do commercial shipbuilding, one in Philadelphia, one in San Diego, outside of building for the Navy. And that's about it. We are just not a big shipbuilding country, which is unfortunate because, as I said in my book, you know, we were a sea power at our founding and we should become one again. We should be investing in the sea and the commercial trade that goes across the sea.
So I want to emphasize again, the United States Navy has four owned and operated shipyards, and there may be as many as 20 commercial shipyards that can service Navy ships. China has 1,200 shipyards, the largest of which produces more tonnage, meaning ships, than any than all of America combined. So the question is, as infrastructure comes up, obviously shipyards and dry dock are infrastructure. How much should be allocated? Where should it be spent? And which states can build them?
Well, right now, I think we could. So on how much, you know, quite frankly, I think we could easily absorb, you know, up to $25 to $40 billion within shipbuilding if we were doing it in a very systematic way. If we went back to the way, like, for instance, Knudsen was managing the industrial base during World War II. And we looked at that sort of a centralized management plan, we could begin looking at that. There is excess capacity. There are dry docks, for instance, in Mississippi and in Alabama, as well as Puerto Rico. The Philly shipyard itself could take additional capacity. There's also Mare Island in California, which I think we have to spend a lot of attention looking at shipyards that are on the Pacific Rim, because that's the most likely place that if there was a conflict, we would bring ships back for repair. And there's also shipyards, for instance, out in Guam. We've already made a significant investment in last year's budget in Pearl Harbor, where we're building an entirely new dry dock there because the old dry docks are not going to be large enough to take the new Virginia Block 5 submarines. So we need to make these investments in order to be ready to anticipate the conflict that we are out there, because you don't want to be caught short-sighted at that point. Once you're into a conflict, it's too late to really anticipate, you know, bringing ships home that have been damaged. So you need to make these as long lead investments now. And like I said, I think that the American shipbuilding industry could absorb easily, you know, $25 to $40 billion at this point, as long as it's a planned investment. You don't want to give one slug and then essentially kind of have it dry up. You need to have a planned investment over a period of time. And fortunately, a lot of the language associated with some of these recent stimulus bills, as well as the infrastructure bill, allow us to do multi-year type investments.
And there are blue states galore. Washington State has shipbuilding capacity. Oregon has shipbuilding capacity. California has a lot of shipbuilding capacity. New York, New Jersey. And then we have some red states, Florida and Texas, and along the Great Lakes, right? There are shipyards that could be built up along the Great. Yeah, this is, if you're going to do pork, and I mean earmark, you can earmark shipyards and serve the national defense.
So also, I mean, you look at ship building along the Mississippi River and along the Ohio River as well. In World War II, we were building Liberty ships all the way up into in Ohio and Indiana on the Ohio River there. And as we look at these large unmanned surface vessels, which are not actually as large as manned vessels, a lot of these could be built on the Great Lakes and on internal waters. But I think the point here is get a plan, understand that the conflict you're coming into, and make sure you're anticipating that and you have the proper investments. I think that right now is the time to begin. So I look at this infrastructure bill as a positive. I just want to make sure that some portion of that is invested in the nation's national security future.
Amen. Go to the Wall Street Journal, get Jerry Hendricks' piece, follow him on Twitter at Jerry Hendricks 2, not the number 2, Roman numeral 2, and come right back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I've tweeted out the captain's article. Go and read it, send it around, and I'll be right back. Welcome Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you so much for joining me. Next hour, I'm going to have George W. Bush join me to talk about his brand new book, Out of Many, One. And I encourage you to watch it on YouTube as I'll be showing some of his portraits, talking with him about immigrants in America and the stories behind them and his comments on policy. So that's at 8:33 Eastern in the next hour. Joined now by James Homan of The Washington Post. He's a columnist at The Post. He's my friend from Minnesota. Hello, James. How are you?
Hey, Hugh, good to be with you. And I love the Bush book. I ordered it. The paintings are great. And it's quite a fun read.
It's an amazing, inspiring read. I look forward to talking to the former president about it at length. And I'll post that over at my podcast, The Interview, later today. I'll talk to you about immigration in a second. First, I want to talk to you about your column. Biden wasn't really ready on day one. His stumble on refugee numbers shows why. Now, many of the people who are profiled in W's book are refugees, and they go through hell to get here. And Biden originally promised during the campaign to raise the refugee numbers. Donald Trump did pretty well on refugees to the last year. Because of COVID, the numbers plummeted. And then there's a false narrative out there, fake news, that he was against refugees. He had very high numbers of refugees until COVID. President Biden has been slow to lift those numbers. What's been the blowback as a result?
The blowback has been significant, and it turns out that it actually is Biden himself. Based on some reporting subsequently, Tony Blinken, whose stepfather, I guess, was a refugee, was a survivor of the Holocaust, personally went to Biden in the Oval Office, pleaded with him not to back off this decision. But Biden is terrified of the optics of what's happening at the southern border, and he feels like people conflate the refugee numbers, which is a separate vetting process from what's happening at the southern border. So it was Biden himself, we're told, who made the decision to back off. Now, the blowback has been so intense that in cleanup mode, the White House said that in mid-May, they're going to raise the cap. And so they kind of backed off of that. And they're still saying they're going to go up to 125,000 refugees next year. But this has had consequences. And it has meant that a lot of people who had plane tickets to get here, who've already, you know, been waiting for years to get here, couldn't come. A pregnant woman, was so late in her pregnancy that, you know, now she's not able to travel. So her child won't be born a U.S. citizen. So the indecision of President Biden has certainly had repercussions.
I want the audience to understand the southern border crisis is that of undocumented people crossing the Rio Grande or walking up to asylum centers, or in some cases, coyotes bring them across the border away from the centers. It's got nothing to do with the refugee process. The refugee process is a very orderly process by which people are brought in after a period of many years due to hardship and extraordinary survival stories. I think of the Lost Boys of the Sudan, one of whom is profiled in President Bush's new book. And I think about the Boat People from Vietnam and the Killing Field refugees and the survivors of the Rwandan and Burundi genocides, the daughter of an assassinated Kremlin figure. The refugees are different, James. And I don't know why the president lacks the confidence in the American people to understand that difference.
Yeah, I think he might be confused. I mean, and the other, I think he totally misread the politics of this. A lot of the refugees are also, you know, they're Christians in places where it, you know, is dangerous to be a Christian. And there's a lot of evangelical support for this refugee program. And so I just think fundamentally, you know, Biden didn't get the distinction. And I think they quickly realized this was a mistake. The blowback from Democrats on Capitol Hill last Friday after they announced that they were going to stick with the 15,000 number was more intense than anything Biden has faced since becoming president from his own left flank.
And it's right to be there. The 15,000 number, again, was President Trump's last year in office when we could not let people in because of COVID. And that's because we didn't have any tests to determine if they had COVID. And now we do have tests and people can be tested. And we probably should revert back to the Trump norm and there wouldn't be any political blowback. It's on immigration. I think our politicians are unusually ham-handed and deaf, dumb and blind, James Homan. I'm going to talk about this with W. I don't think immigration reform is that difficult. If we move to a wall on the southern border, let everybody stay and move to merit based, it would be over. I mean, it just is not that hard to me. Do you think it's that hard?
I don't. I really don't. And I think politicians in both parties make it harder than it needs to be because they get political mileage out of it. But, you know, anyone can sit down, you know, and figure out what the compromise is. It's why every time the compromise ends up looking close to something similar. You can give or take a little bit here and there, but yeah, you have to give and you have to take. And you're absolutely right. If you embrace the merit system, that it solves so many of the problems.
And people talk themselves into corner, driven there by the extremes in the party. And Debbie made some comments. He said there are natives and the Republicans. Yeah, there are. They're not that many, but they usually dominate the Twitter conversation. There are hardliners who are probably representative of the party as a whole, but the hardliners want merit and they want the wall, but they're not. I don't see anybody. You know, I've been covering this for 25 years and I've written about it since 2004. I've never seen anybody who's sane call for the removal of the 14 to 20 million people in the United States who are here without papers if they are not violent or somehow connected with crime. And you know that living in the Twin Cities, you know the Somali population. They're largely a refugee population, not an illegal immigrant population. There is no mass deportation rhetoric that abounds in Maine and in Minnesota.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, in the Somalis, I mean, it's a huge, they've changed the complexion of the community. And, but it is, you know, Minneapolis has the largest Somali population outside of Somalia now. And it's a result of our country being a welcoming place. And many of them are contributing very fruitfully to society.
I think Portland, Maine is the second. I don't know why they send these people from hot countries to Minnesota and Maine, but they do. It's really, there's one story in W's book about a refugee from Vietnam, a Da Nang orphan, who gets adopted by an American sergeant who takes her to the shores of Lake Superior, a few miles south of Lake Superior. I think to myself, that poor girl. I mean, my goodness. Go from Da Nang jungle to Lake Superior, Michigan. Hello, America. So, Holman, I want to talk to you about the debt limit. It's the annual passion play. The Republicans came out yesterday and said, okay. And what I don't like in the media is they're treating this as though it's the ordinary debt limit. It's not. We've spent $6 trillion in response to the virus, just like we spent trillions of dollars in response to 2008. This is not a normal year. We've spent more money than we've ever spent in the history of the Republic. They need to do something, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there needs to, it'll definitely force the conversation about debt that that hasn't happened. And, it is one of those things where, like, you and I disagree on this, I think, a little bit, in the sense that, like, Biden wants to spend money on infrastructure and he's talking about ways to pay for it. And I think even if the ways are bad, it's good to actually have a conversation about how you're going to pay for spending again, which hasn't happened the last 15 months amid COVID. And so having the debt limit conversation is important. And it just feels like most voters are not keyed in on how problematic the debt is and how close we are to really bad levels of inflation.
Oh, we are very, very close to bad levels of inflation. People listen to Hugh Hewitt Show. I don't know that we disagree. I don't want to raise the corporate income tax, but I do want sales taxes to go up. I think consumption taxes are the way to, without inflation, make sure that we can pay for the infrastructure. User taxes and consumption taxes are the way to go. And people say they're aggressive. And I say, no, they're actually visible. That's why Democrats don't like them. They're visible. And people don't like visible taxes like property taxes and income taxes. They want corporate taxes, which then appear up on your bill via price increases. And that's where the Democrats are wrong. The question is, though, we will have a debt limit passion play. And do you expect that the politics of it will be any different than they have been for the last 10 years?
No, I don't. I think, you know, depending on the timing of when it kind of comes front and center. This infrastructure bill, I think, is in more trouble than a lot of people think for Democrats. Like, it's not a slam dunk. It's definitely going to end up getting slimmed down pretty significantly. And then after that passes, it's unclear what else Biden can really get done, spending wise. And so then I think that you could see a real shift in the conversation where some of the vulnerable members, on the Democratic side in the House and Senate start kind of trying to talk a little bit more about austerity instead of kind of it doesn't matter how much we spend.
Now, Holman, you're a millennial, right?
Yep.
Did you read the New York Times piece this morning on millennials and the YOLO movement?
I didn't.
it is the most ridiculous article. It's entitled Welcome to the YOLO Economy. Burned out and flush with savings, some workers are quitting stable jobs in search of post-pandemic adventure. By Kevin Ruse. Now, are you burned out?
I'm not. I love my job.
And do you have savings?
Some, yeah, I do.
Are you quitting the Post?
I will not. And it is, I mean, this generation, when you asked that question, it made me cringe because I'm not a proud millennial by any stretch.
Well, I think this is the stupidest article, and I don't think it's fair, actually. I had dinner with three millennials last night who were working their butts off. One just got back from deployment. I talked to you. Every young millennial journalist I know has got like three side hustles as well as their regular day gig. And here we've got Twitter employees are getting an extra day off per month called Day of Rest. Credit Suisse is giving its junior bankers $20,000 lifestyle allowances. Fearful of an exodus, LinkedIn recently gave a majority of its employees a paid week off. This is ridiculous. I mean, this is nobody that I know in the information economy actually works hard, physically works hard. Am I wrong?
No, it's one of those. It's this weird kind of the upper educated liberal elites are talking about how, you know, like, oh, it's just so exhausting. Like you heard that term all the time. And it is kind of like you're not working really, you know, and you're not doing physical work. It is perplexing. And I think it does reflect the softness of the generation.
You know, back when I used to lay bricks with my hands and build my own house on the prairie and the wind was going down. Yeah, it's just so absurd. And I think you ought to read this. And I hope you'll turn your column to it. Because your generation is getting a bad MO. I mean, it's really not very fair, but it's getting this bad MO. Now, there are lots of millennials running around the Post, right?
There are.
Yeah. So go and show them this article, because I think there might be. I don't know any lazy millennials at the Post. By the way, have you got a new editor yet?
It's Ruth Marcus, my editor.
No, no. I mean, over at the paper, the big editor, the Marty Baron replacement.
Oh, no, we don't. We don't.
You work for Ruth, Ruthless Ruth?
Yeah.
And you used to work for Steve, the tyrant Steve Ginsburg. Now you're working for Ruthless Ruth? Oh, my gosh. You are a millennial who might. I know. I love Ruth, and I love Steve. Be well, Homan. Go and read his brand-new millennial-driven story on Joe Biden not being ready on day one. It's a great column. I love talking to Homan. Don't go anywhere, America. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by former United States Senator Jim Talent, who represented Missouri while he was in the Senate. You can now read him at Jim Talent on Twitter. Good morning, Jim. I got two stories to talk with you about. It is Putin's speech yesterday and Jerry Hendricks' op-ed in the Journal today. Can we start with Putin warning about a Russian red line? What is the president of Russia up to?
I've loved your interviews this week with Cotton and Mike Gallagher talking about Putin in Ukraine. I would just say this to you. The initiative now has passed firmly into the hands of the aggressors. They have the power on the ground, and deterrence is failing in their regions of the world. And I think he's basically signaling this. He can move anytime he wants to move. Now, that doesn't mean he will. These are political decisions that these regimes have to make, and there are other considerations that they're taking into account. But he's pushing us around. And a lot of the reason is we simply no longer have the power on the ground to do anything about it. He's also testing the will of the Biden administration. And for all the reasons that Mike and Tom were talking about, you know, he's finding weakness there. And they're going to continue doing this. I mean, we are in a period of consequences, you. This is where we're in now.
I suggested that NATO forward deploy more troops to the Baltics, Poland, and any other state in which they are welcome and bordering Russia, except Ukraine, because I don't think we're ready for a NATO-Russia collision. What do you make of that suggestion?
Oh, I think it'd be great if we had people. And this is the one thing that I thought when I was watching your interview with Mike. I would love to see how Mike would answer that question. I'd love him to death, but I don't think we have them in. We didn't have them in 5 years ago when we were doing the QDR commission, and we asked that question of the administration. Same thing with the ships. We can't surge ships to all these places at once. We don't have them.
Well, that brings us to Jerry Hendricks' op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today. Want infrastructure, build shipyards. It's kind of stunning when you read that the United States has four shipyards owned and operated by the U.S. Navy and maybe 20 more commercial that are capable of servicing the U.S. Navy, and China has 1,200 shipyards. That's kind of stunning.
That's right. And I'm afraid we're going to see the third whiff now from the Department of Defense. They whiffed on the coronavirus bill. They basically whiffed on the budget. Their top line is lower than Trump's, and Trump's was not enough, and I said so. And now they have the infrastructure bill. Listen, the Office of Secretary of Defense has to go into that administration, any administration, and fight for their equities, first and foremost, the funding they need to defend the country. If they don't do it, nobody's going to do it. I mean, the OMB's not going to do it. They don't want to spend money. Nobody else in the administration is going to do it. Otherwise, it'll just be passed on to the Congress, and this Congress, I greatly fear, is not going to do it.
Now Senator Talent, there are shipyards in Washington State, in Oregon, in California. There are shipyards in Maine, which is a blue-red state, in Massachusetts, which is a blue state, in New Hampshire, which is a red state, in Florida, which is a red state, in Texas, which is a red state, and in Mississippi, which is a red state. There are shipyards everywhere. How can they not get 60 votes for an infrastructure bill taking care of shipyards?
Well, I think it would be a great thing to do, also from the standpoint of getting bipartisan support for that bill. I mean, the number one reason is national security, but I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it would make the bill possible to pass, even with some tax increases, and at least the potential is there, Hugh. You know, we've bought on average about 8 ships a year for the last 30 years. The Chinese have bought at minimum double that, and they could do 24 ships a year easily if they wanted to. So the shipyard industrial base has shrunk. You can't just flip a switch and produce a ship. So we need to begin building up now. Now, we have a problem in the next 3 to 5 years, as Gallagher talked about, because we can't just spit these ships out, and we need them now.
And we can't even repair them. In Hendricks's piece, we've got the USS Boise has lost 10% of its useful life waiting to get repaired because they don't have a dry dock at which to have the repairs completed.
Yeah, I know. Have you talked to Jerry yet this morning? I just got up.
Yeah, I did. He was on at the top of the hour.
Remember, he talked in his book about the material debt spiral. Okay, so, you know, when you don't have enough money to maintain the ships, you start falling behind in maintenance, and then you don't have the capacity to catch up quickly, even if you have the money, right? So the ships go unmaintained, which means they can't be deployed as much, which means you have fewer ships to deploy, which means the ships that are out there aren't being maintained either because they're out there too long. It's the material death spiral. And he says it in his column. He says we have to retire about 50 ships in the next few years because we didn't maintain them properly.
The first step is the shipyard. And the first step is this infrastructure bill. And if the Republicans want to strike a blow for freedom and the Department of Defense will get their butts. And this is not, by the way, a Democratic problem. They sat through 4 years of Trump budgets not making their demands either. And that's on their Navy secretaries.
I agree. It's on everybody at OSD. The first thing you got to do is go in there and fight like a tiger for the equities of your department, which is first and foremost, of course, the top fund. You just have to sit down at OMB and with the White House chief of staff and then with the president say, look, this is what I have to have. And they would have tremendous clout if they did that. We'll see what they do. They obviously haven't done it so far.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt here. Looking forward to talking to former President Bush at the bottom of the hour about his brand new book, Out of Many, One. So stay tuned to that. You might want to watch that over at my YouTube channel, since we'll be showing you some of the portraits that President Bush painted and talking about the people in them. I begin the hour, though, with Congressman Tom Emmer, Minnesota's 6th Congressional District. Good morning, Congressman. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hugh. Hope you're well.
I am. I've got an agenda this morning. I want to talk to you about the NRCC, and then I want to talk to you about the Financial Services Task Force. Let's start with the National Republican Congressional Committee. How do things look for 2022?
Well, we recently released a memo outlining our most recent internal polling of battleground districts across the country. And, Hugh, the takeaway from this memo was in the 16 ticket-splitting districts, Republicans hold an 8-point advantage on the generic ballot. By the way, there are not enough words to describe just how unpopular and toxic Nancy Pelosi is again with the voters. And by the way, voters absolutely reject Democrats as they learn more about Nancy Pelosi's socialist agenda and the Pelosi payoff, which is this, H.R. 1 and the $1.9 trillion, as they just learn more and more about the crony politics that are being played in Washington, D.C. by these new socialist Democrats. things look good for Republicans.
$600 million for the city of San Francisco, $200 million for the city of Kansas City. I'm astonished that the Georgia senators voted for this bill, Congressman Emmer, and I'm sure you're going to drive home what New York City got and what San Francisco got compared to what every other city in America got.
Hey, all the blue states, Hugh, they were running surpluses, too. Don't forget that. They had surpluses. And Nancy Pelosi and her Socialist Democrat majority in the House and those two Democrat senators in Georgia, they're just paying off their political cronies. America will know.
Okay, but now tell me, will America know which district they're in? Because the redistricting has been slowed down by the census ability to tell us how many seats go where and for the state legislatures to get to their constitutional duties to apportion the seats.
You're correct about that. I mean, we're going to find out April 30th. We're supposed to find out what the actual numbers are. We'll know which states are gaining seats, which states are losing seats. Right now, September 30th is probably the date that we're going to get the actual block data that will tell us how we can draw maps. We may be lucky and get a possibly a month earlier, but what that means, Hugh, is that our state legislatures will literally be drawing maps between September and probably February or March of next year, the election year. So there will be some states that have to work to push back primaries. Regardless, once those districts are clear, then you're going to have incumbents and new candidates, challengers, racing to a primary and then to a general election. But I'm really confident for Republicans. State legislatures are going to draw roughly 170 seats, Republican-controlled state legislatures, of the 435. Compare that with the Democrats, Hugh, they're going to draw about 45 of them. So we're going to make sure that the rules and the procedures are followed to maximize redistricting opportunities. And I think we're going to do very well in the redistricting cycle.
Now, Congressman Emmer, before I turn over to FinTech, there was an attempt to censure Maxine Waters, who I've known for a long time. I've been interviewing her when I was on PBS Nightly News for years in L.A., and she's always incendiary, and she always says very, very disturbing things. But not one Democrat, not one, voted to censure her. Do you think that vote will, among others, be front and center for these swing district Democrats?
It's going to be devastating, Hugh. I mean, first off, this isn't a typical incendiary protest. Maxine Waters flew to the state of Minnesota while a jury was deliberating a very serious case with serious charges. And as the judge said in his own words, she created the basis for an appeal. This is it's disgusting at the very least. At the most, it's absolutely worthy of censure. And so you know, Hugh, and so your listeners know, in order to keep all of their members in line, you had the other night when this vote, Kevin McCarthy brought this vote on Monday afternoon, you had Steny Hoyer standing at one door to the House floor. You had Nancy Pelosi standing at the other door, something that I'm told by people who have been here for many terms they've never seen. And they were absolutely strong-arming all of their members, including these members in swing districts. Look at Minnesota. You've got Angie Craig and you've got Dean Phillips who voted not to censure Maxine Waters in their own state, not to mention Jared Golden in Maine and Cindy Axne in Iowa. And the list goes on and on. We've targeted 29 of these districts where you have Democrat incumbents in districts that Donald Trump either won in 2020 or it was decided within 5 points. And, Hugh, so your listeners know just how close this is. The difference right now between the majority and the minority is 222 if you had a full slate of representatives to 213. The difference between having a majority is five seats, 213 to 218. Do you know, Hugh, that the difference across the country between being at 213 and 218 last November was only 31,700 votes. So those districts that we've targeted, they were they're on a razor's edge. And yes, that vote against censuring Maxine Waters for these abhorrent remarks and her behavior, it is going to come back and haunt them in November of 22.
Now, Congressman Emmer, you also serve as the ranking member of the Financial Services Subcommittee on the Financial Services Task Force. And I note that yesterday the Biden administration had nominated Lina Khan, a big tech critic, to be a member of the Federal Trade Commission. There is some overlap between fintech and big tech, not complete. I am curious what your agenda is for the fintech task force. Financial technology is changing, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, availability. What is your agenda on that task force?
Well, number one is to raise awareness. I think, you know, if you're 40 years old or younger, you're thinking differently than if you're 50 years old, for instance, and older. Not to say that those of us that are over the age of 50, Hugh, aren't capable of learning this area. But we start from a different place. So one is raising awareness, especially with members of Congress, because you've got an entrepreneurial class out there that is doing some amazing things with blockchain technology. Part of it you've mentioned has to do with our currency or with Bitcoin and these cryptocurrencies. Here's where I come from, though. It's a little bit different from where I think the Biden administration comes from, and obviously from where big tech would come from. You know, Facebook wants to start its own cryptocurrency called Libra. That would be a closed system that they control. This is what the Chinese are doing with their yuan. You know, they're creating a digital yuan. It's something that the Chinese can not only monitor, but they can control with their citizens. I would love to empower the individual, Hugh. This is an expansion that allows you and I to have more control over our own decisions. The key is making sure that our privacy concerns are constantly met. And it's really about giving the individual the right to self-determine, as opposed to having these big government, big tech solutions that are nothing more than, you know, more control disguised as opportunity. So we'll see where it goes. Maxine Waters, who's our chairman, is deathly afraid of these fintech opportunities. That's why she only made this a task force. I guarantee you that once the Republicans take back the majority, the fintech task force will become the subcommittee and a full-blown subcommittee. So that's where we're coming from, and we hope to continue to advance financial technology opportunities, which will give more people more access. It'll streamline financial transactions, hopefully reduce the cost, and create more opportunity for the future.
Now, Congressman, I've actually talked to Zuckerberg about the Facebook Libra, because I'm not a proponent of this because I fear it undermines the dollar's position as a reserve currency. But that's one conversation. What China is doing with digital currency is another, and that's just a police state using cyber capabilities to track every transaction. Are you confident that if we go to digital currency, the Chinese aren't going to be able to hack that and the Chinese Communist Party follow the money in the United States everywhere?
No, Hugh, I'm not. I mean, I think that's something that should be of paramount concern. We had an expert in about a year ago after the pandemic started that talked about in China when this when the COVID outbreak started. Guess what? The Chinese government was able to lock down the debit cards, if you will. There's a card that they use. You weren't able to get out of Wuhan once they locked it down. The government controlled all that. You weren't able to buy a hotel room. You weren't able to buy transportation. The government effectively locked you. Some might argue held you in place. That's not what we want this for, and I think we have to be very aware whether it's Libra or it's what the Chinese are doing. Look, Hugh, I saw a report that the Olympics, which I question why we're involved in the Olympics with Beijing, especially when you see the outrage in this country over things with Major League Baseball, etc. Be wary when they give every Olympian a digital wand.
Oh, my gosh, you're right about that. Congressman Tom Emmer, hadn't thought about that. Thank you. Keep coming back, Congressman. NRCC on Twitter. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.